From the KTOO newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry. Rear Admiral Megan Dean now commands the U.S. Coast Guard in Alaska. And as far as anyone can remember, she's the first woman to do so. Dean was sworn in at a change of command ceremony in Juneau today. After the ceremony, Dean said she spent a lot of her career in Florida, and she's anticipating different challenges here in Alaska.
I think a lot of it up here is just obviously, you all know, the weather and then the tyranny of distance and time.
Dean says she thinks it's important for other women in the Coast Guard to see someone like them in positions of leadership. But she rejects the idea that being a woman makes her more or less capable in this role.
I'm the Coast Guard officer, not a female Coast Guard officer. I have had an incredible career, been given lots of opportunities, you know, and I think that's because I've been competent in the job that I'm in.
Last year, Admiral Linda Fagan became the Commandant of the Coast Guard, the first woman to lead any branch of the U.S. military. The Coast Guard could not confirm on Friday that Dean is the first woman to lead the Coast Guard in Alaska, but a list going back to 1964 shows only men in the role. Coast Guard District 17 has its administrative offices in Juneau and runs all of Alaska's Coast Guard operations. Nearly 2,000 people work for District 17, and it patrols more than 47,000 miles of shoreline. Last year, the district conducted 521 search and rescues, saving nearly 200 lives, according to Coast Guard data. Dean says that her Florida background means she's already familiar with working in an area with a lot of cruise ship tourism.
When I came across the bridge from Douglas on Wednesday, I think it was, and I looked over and I'm like, that's five cruise ships over there. I think I had awareness of it, but it was pretty eye-opening.
She said that as the cruise industry expands north in the state, so do the risks of challenging evacuation and rescue operations. Dean is replacing Rear Admiral Nathan Moore, who has held the position since 2021. Her first mission is a trip to Kodiak, Cordova, and Kotzebue to meet more of the people who make up Coast Guard District 17. The National Marine Fisheries Service hasn't ruled out the possibility of opening the summer troll season for king salmon in southeast Alaska, despite a federal judge's recent ruling to the contrary. During a meeting held Wednesday in Sitka, NOAA's Regional Fisheries Administrator for Alaska, John Kurland, told a roomful of trollers that the agency was working hard to correct the problems identified in a federal lawsuit brought by a conservation group in Washington state. If successful, southeast trollers might be able to harvest king salmon this summer, if not on the traditional date of July 1st, then possibly in August. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
To get a feel for the impact of the Wild Fish Conservancy lawsuit on southeast trollers, try sitting in a room filled with them. Grizzled oldsters, seasoned men and women hardened by life on the ocean, well-known fisheries advocates, young families, and a baby or two. John Kurland is the Regional Administrator for Fisheries in the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which, among other agencies, oversees the National Marine Fisheries Service. That's a lengthy title, but Kurland said that he is a neighbor, and he gets it.
First off, I know that there's been just a huge amount of concern about the implications of this suit and the potential for the troll fishery not to be able to open. I live in Juneau. I have a sense of how important this fishery is for southeast Alaska, for a lot of small businesses, a lot of families, a lot of communities. It's a big deal.
The Washington state-based Wild Fish Conservancy sued the National Marine Fisheries Service in federal court in 2020, arguing that nymphs had violated the Endangered Species Act by failing to fully account for the impact of southeast trolling on king salmon, an important prey for a small population of endangered orcas in Puget Sound called southern resident killer whales. The Conservancy won, and a judge ordered southeast Alaska king salmon trolling shut down until the problem could be remedied. And it's just commercial trolling for Chinook in southeast Alaska. No other commercial or sport fishery anywhere from Alaska to California is affected. It's a baffling strategy, and Kurland is as surprised as anyone that the suit got this far.
We're all sort of incredulous that this suit is focusing on southeast Alaska fisheries when there are a lot bigger threats that southern resident killer whales are facing than what's happening in these fisheries. The southeast Alaska fisheries are a really small contributor to the challenges that southern resident killer whales face in their recovery. But anyway, it is what it is.
Kurland explained the nuts and bolts of the lawsuit, which were already known to many in the standing room only crowd in Sitka's Harrigan Centennial Hall, how it stemmed from a 2019 biological opinion prepared by nymphs and the associated incidental take statement required to conduct a fishery that could affect an endangered species. Although the National Marine Fisheries Service has appealed to the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and asked for a decision in June, it's unlikely that the court would act so fast. Instead, Kurlant, without giving away too much legal strategy, said NIMS had one trump card it could play.
The agency has the authority under the Endangered Species Act to issue a new biological opinion and a new incidental take statement. It could be reviewed by the court. The court doesn't need to approve it up front, but it's certainly possible that the plaintiffs will take issue with whatever we put out, and will ask the court to review it. But there is no implicit requirement or explicit requirement for the court to approve it before it takes effect.
This prompted troller Robert Bateman to drill down.
It's my understanding that once the ITS and the new biop has been written, and correct me if I'm wrong, you can basically put that in effect straight away. Now, if that didn't happen before July 1st, could we maybe go fishing in August still?
So your question is, if we are not able to get the new incidental take coverage in place by July 1st, but we get it in later, could there be an opening later in the season? Yes.
Kurlant was joined at the meeting by an attorney from the U.S. Department of Justice, which is representing the National Marine Fisheries Service. Kurlant explained that the DOJ stepped in any time someone sues the government, and he said, "I get sued all the time." Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Pouring rain didn't stop a special ceremony honoring a one-of-a-kind canoe last week. Tribal members and Ketchikan residents gathered to awaken and launch a canoe designed by a late master carver, an artist who called Ketchikan one of his homes. As KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, it was a joyous occasion full of tradition.
When I say haigwa, you say ah. Haigwa! Ah!
Dozens of people shout in the Haida language as they heave together, carrying the canoe to the water. The canoe has a fiberglass hull with wood underneath and is painted red, white, and black. A design of running salmon swirls around the canoe. When someone gets tired, another steps in. It's a show of teamwork and of strength.
So of all the people that are going to be holding the canoe, if anything feels unsafe or unsturdy, make sure you yell it out so everybody knows so we can fix it.
Earlier in the afternoon, a big crowd of tribal members and Ketchikan residents had gathered for an awakening ceremony. The canoe was designed by the late Marvin Oliver. Oliver owned Alaska Eagle Arts in downtown Ketchikan, but also had art installations around the world. He was a professor and a curator and had won an award for his work in diversity. Canoes run in the family. Oliver's father created the paddle to Seattle. Several speakers share their thoughts during the awakening part of the ceremony before the launching. They include Ketchikan Indian community staff and tribal members, and Oliver's family. His wife, Bridget Ellis, stands in front of her husband's creation alongside her family. She talks about respecting the canoe's place in Indigenous culture.
First thing I want to share with you is you never say the B word. It's spelled B-O-A-T. In traditional canoe culture, the canoe is always a canoe and never the B word. It is said if a paddler speaks of the vessel as a B word, that paddler will be thrown into the water. You learn really fast to call it a canoe at all times.
She says that Oliver felt connected to canoes because of his father's role in the paddle to Seattle and his Salish heritage.
The canoe revitalization will empower the youth. That's what he and I had in mind. To carry these important traditions forward. It's the canoe that fosters a healthy sense of identity among young Indigenous people. Those youth that struggle emotionally come together and say canoe culture is a life-changing event.
Oliver died in 2019, but the year before, the tribe's council bought the canoe. Tribe leaders say that the canoe and canoe journeys will advance the tribe's strategic plan, which focuses on uniting the community and spreading culture. Norman Scan is the Ketchikan Indian Community President.
We already have our dance, we have our arts, we have our subsistence food, and this is just another component of the wholeness that we are slowly becoming.
The canoe also receives its name. Brothers Richard and Willie Jackson named the canoe Hootskayak, or Brown Bear Spirit. Willie Jackson explains their choice.
He is your protector on this canoe.
Before the canoe is carried into the water, there is drumming, singing, and an acknowledgement of the Indigenous people who have lived on the land since time immemorial. Adults lift up children and help them drape cedar boughs on the canoe. After the canoe is floating, the mood is joyous. There's dancing and singing. Some wear cedar hats and drum, and others dance in their soggy jeans and sneakers. In Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.